So you think that money is the root of all evil? Said Francisco de Anconia. Have you ever asked what is the root of money? Money is a tool of exchange, which can't exist unless there are goods produced and men able to produce them. Money is the material shape of the principle of men who wish to deal with one another must deal by trade and give value for value. Money is not the tool of the moochers who claim your product by tears or of the looters who take it from you by force. Money is made possible only by the men who produce it. Is this what you consider evil? When you accept money in payment for your effort, you do so only on the conviction that you will exchange it for the product of the effort of others. It is not the moochers or the looters who give value to money. Not an ocean of tears nor all the guns in the world can transform those pieces of paper in your wallet into the bread you will need to survive tomorrow. Those pieces of paper, which should have been gold, are a token of honor, your claim upon the energy of the men who produce. Your wallet is your statement of hope that somewhere in the world around you there are men who will not default on that moral principle, which is the root of money. Is this what you consider evil? Have you ever looked for the root of production? Take a look at the electric generator and dare tell yourself that it was created by the muscular effort of unthinking brutes. Try to grow a seed of wheat without the knowledge left to you by the men who had to discover it for the first time. Try to obtain your food by means of nothing but physical motions, and you'll learn that man's mind is the root of all the goods produced and of all the wealth that has ever existed on earth. But you say that money is made by the strong at the expense of the weak? What strength do you mean? It is not the strength of guns or muscles. Wealth is the product of man's capacity to think. Then is money made by the man who invents a motor at the expense of those who did not invent it? Is money made by the intelligent at the expense of the fools? By the able at the expense of the incompetent? By the ambitious at the expense of the lazy? Money is made, before it can be looted or mooched, made by an effort of every honest man, each to the extent of his ability. An honest man is one who knows that he can't consume more than he has produced. To trade by means of money is the code of men of goodwill. Money rests on the axiom that every man is the owner of his mind and his effort. Money allows no power to prescribe the value of your effort except the voluntary choice of the man who is willing to trade you his effort in return. Money permits you to obtain for your goods and your labor that which they are worth to the men who buy them, but no more. Money permits no deals except those to mutual benefit by the unforced judgment of the traders. Money demands of you the recognition that men must work for their own benefit, not for their own injury, for their gain, not for their loss. The recognition they are not beasts of burden born to carry the weight of your misery. That you must offer them values, not wounds. That the common bond among men is not the exchange of suffering, but the exchange of goods. Money demands that you sell, not your weakness to men's stupidity, but your talent to their reason. It demands that you buy, not the shoddiest they offer, but the best that your money can find. And when men live by trade with reason, not force, as their final arbiter, it is the best product that wins, the best performance. The man of best judgment and highest ability, and the degree of man's productiveness is the degree of his reward. This is the code of existence, whose tools and symbol is money. Is this what you consider evil? But money is only a tool. It will take you wherever you wish, but it will not replace you as the driver. It will give you the means for the satisfaction of your desires, but it will not provide you with desires. Money is the scourge of the men who attempt to reverse the law of causality, the men who seek to replace the mind by seizing the products of the mind. Money will not produce happiness for the man who has no concept of what he wants. Money will not give him a code of values if he's evaded the knowledge of what to value. And it will not provide him with a purpose if he's evaded the choice of what to seek. Money will not buy intelligence for the fool, or admiration for the coward, or respect for the incompetent. The man who attempts to purchase the brains of his superiors to serve him, with his money replacing his judgment, ends up becoming the victim of his inferiors. The men of intelligence desert him, but the cheats and the frauds come flocking to him. Drawn by a law which he has not discovered, that no man may be smaller than his money. Is this the reason why you call it evil? Only the man who does not need it is fit to inherit wealth. The man who would make his own fortune, no matter where he started. If an heir is equal to his money, it serves him. If not, it destroys him. But you look on and you cry that money corrupted him. Did it? Or did he corrupt his money? Do not envy a worthless heir. His wealth is not yours, and you would have done no better with it. Do not think that it should have been distributed among you, loading the world with 50 parasites instead of one. Would not bring back the dead virtue, which was the fortune. Money is a living power that dies without its root. Money will not serve the mind that cannot match it. Is this the reason why you call it evil? Money is your means of survival. The verdict you pronounce upon the source of your livelihood is the verdict you pronounce upon your life. If the source is corrupt, you have damned your own existence. Did you get your money by fraud? By pandering to men's vices or men's stupidity? By catering to fools in the hopes of getting more than your ability deserves? By lowering your standards? By doing work you despise for purchasers you scorn? If so, then your money will not give you a moment's or a penny's worth of joy. Then all the things you buy will become not a tribute to you, but a reproach. Not an achievement, but a reminder of shame. Then you'll scream that money is evil. Evil because it would not pinch hit for your self-respect. Evil because it would not let you enjoy your depravity. Is this the root of your hatred of money? Money will always remain an effect and refuse to replace you as the cause. Money is the product of virtue, but it will not give you virtue, and it will not redeem your vices. Money will not give you the unearned, neither in matter nor in spirit. Is this the root of your hatred of money? Or did you say it's the love of money that's the root of all evil? To love a thing is to know and love its nature. To love money is to know and love the fact that money is the creation of the best power within you, and your pass key to trade your effort for the effort of the best among men. It's the person who would sell his soul for a nickel who is the loudest in proclaiming his hatred of money. And he has good reason to hate it. The lovers of money are willing to work for it. They know they are able to deserve it. Let me give you a tip on a clue to men's characters. The man who damns money has obtained it dishonorably. The man who respects it has earned it. Run for your life from any man who tells you that money is evil. That sentence is a leper's bell of an approaching looter. So long as men live together on earth and need means to deal with one another, their only substitute if they abandon money is the muzzle of a gun. But money demands of you the highest virtues, if you wish to make it or to keep it. Men who have no courage, pride, or self-esteem, men who have no moral sense of their right to the money and are not willing to defend it as they defend their life, men who apologize for being rich, will not remain rich for long. They are the natural bait for the swarms of looters that stay under rocks for centuries, but come crawling out at the first smell of a man who begs to be forgiven for the guilt of owning wealth. They will hasten to relieve him of the guilt and of his life as he deserves. Then you will see the rise of men of the double standard, the men who live by force yet count on those who live by trade to create the value of their looted money. The men who are the hitchhikers of virtue. In a moral society, these are the criminals, and the statutes are written to protect you against them. But when a society establishes criminal by right and looters by law, men who use force to seize the wealth of disarmed victims, then money becomes its creator's avenger. Such looters believe it safe to rob defenseless men once they've passed a law to disarm them. But their loot becomes the magnet for other looters, who get it from them as they got it. Then the race goes. Not to the ablest at production, but to those most ruthless at brutality. When force is a standard, the murderer wins over the pickpocket. And then that society vanishes. in a spread of ruins and slaughter. Do you wish to know whether that day is coming? Watch money. Money is the barometer of a society's virtue. When you see that trading is done not by consent but compulsion, when you see that in order to produce, you need to obtain permission from men who produce nothing, when you see that money is flowing to those who deal not in goods but in favors, when you see that men get richer by graft and by pull than by work, and your laws don't protect you against them but protect them against you, when you see corruption being rewarded and honesty becoming self-sacrifice, you may know that your society is doomed. Money is so noble a medium that it does not compete with guns and it does not make terms with brutality. It will not permit a country to survive as half property, half loot. Whenever destroyers appear among men, they start by destroying money. For money is men's protection and the base of a moral existence. Destroyers seize gold and leave to its owners a counterfeit pile of paper. This kills all objective standards and delivers men into the arbitrary power of an arbitrary setter of values. Gold was an objective value, an equivalent of wealth produced. Paper is a mortgage on wealth that does not exist, backed by a gun aimed at those who are expected to produce it. Paper is a check drawn by legal looters upon an account which is not theirs, upon the virtue of the victims. Watch for the day when it bounces, marked account overdrawn. When you have made evil the means of survival, do not expect men to remain good. Do not expect them to stay moral and lose their lives for the purpose of becoming the fodder of the immoral. Do not expect them to produce when production is punished and looting rewarded. Do not ask who is destroying the world. You are. You stand in the midst of the greatest productive civilization and you wonder why it's crumbling around you while you're damning its lifeblood, money. You look upon money as the savages did before you, and you wonder why the jungle is creeping back to the edges of your cities. Throughout man's history, money was always seized by looters of one brand or another, whose names changed but whose methods remained the same. To seize wealth by force and to keep the producers bound, demeaning, defamed, deprived of honor. That phrase about the evil of money, which you mouth with such righteous recklessness, comes from a time when wealth was produced by the labor of slaves. Slaves who repeated the motions once discovered by somebody's mind and left unimproved for centuries, so long as production was ruled by force and wealth was obtained by conquest, there was little to conquer. Yet through all the centuries of stagnation and starvation, men exalted the looters. As aristocrats of the sword, as aristocrats of birth, as aristocrats of the bureau, and despised the producers. As slaves, as traders, as shopkeepers, as industrialists. To the glory of mankind, there was, for the first and only time in history, a country of money. And I have no higher, more reverent tribute to pay to America, for this means a country of reason, justice, freedom, production, achievement. For the first time, man's mind and money were set free, and there were no fortunes by conquest, but only fortunes by work. And instead of swordsmen and slaves, there appeared the real maker of wealth, the greatest worker, the highest type of human being, the self-made man, the American industrialist. If you ask me to name the proudest distinction of Americans, I would choose, because it contains all the others, the fact that they were the people who created the phrase to make money. No other language or nation had ever used these words before. Men had always thought of wealth as a static quantity, to be seized, begged, inherited, shared, looted, or obtained as a favor. Americans were the first to understand that the wealth has to be created. The words to make money hold the essence of human morality. Yet these were the words for which Americans were denounced by the rotted cultures of the looters' continents. Now the looters' credo has brought you to regard your proudest achievements as a hallmark of shame, your prosperity as guilt, your greatest men, the industrialists, as blackguards, and your magnificent factories as the product and property of muscular labor, the labor of whip-driven slaves like the pyramids of Egypt, the rotter who simpers that he sees no difference between the power of the dollar and the power of the whip, ought to learn the difference on his own hide, as I think he will, Until and unless you discover that money is the root of all good, you ask for your own destruction. When money ceases to be a tool by which men deal with one another, then men become the tools of men. Blood, whips, and guns, or dollars. Take your choice. There is no other, and your time is running out. That was an excerpt of a character from Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. And that is where we are. We have a society that has begun the process of attacking those very people that would create, that would drive, that would push and make America what it should be. And now we all have to adapt and adjust to that.
Victory or death!
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 Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Radio Free Virginia. I'm your host, Hank Reardon, and this is episode 21-06. Do you ever feel like you're living in the Matrix? I don't really feel like I'm living in a computer program, but do you understand what I'm saying? If you haven't seen the movie, you wouldn't understand the question. But most everyone has seen it or seen bits and pieces of it. You understand what the concept is. We're living in some weird computer simulation. And some of us know it, and some of us can see it. And we see, right now, what's going on all around us. You hear the news reports. You see the news reports. You read something. You read an article. And you can see between the lines if you're paying attention. I'm paying attention. I hope you are. But that's where we're at. You can see what's going on. And I felt like that this week when I was listening. I turned on the radio in my car, going to my job or whatever it was I was doing. And I could see the lines of code and everything that they were saying. Oh, the jobless numbers is very concerning, and it's all because of COVID-19. Actually, a lot of it's because of Bumbles and the installation of a doddering idiot as president. Completely in opposition to everything that is right and just and true. Some of you see it. In fact, I would say most, if not all of you that are listening to this, probably see it. And if you just pay attention a tiny bit, everyone can see it. But you have people, they don't want to see it. They want to hear good, only good, always good, everything good. They don't want to admit that there is a alternate view of the way this world is that is actually true, other than what they have in their eyes, what they see with their eyes. Cognitive dissonance, I believe. Maybe it's normalcy bias. I don't know. But we better start waking up to what's going on all around us. Found this article in Politico. And I'm going to share it with you because while it's talking about the national political scene and what the Bumbles administration must do, it is a signal of the way that these people think about you, the way they think about the South, and what plans they have for you. It's from Politico. Yes, I know, communist. It is titled, What Ulysses S. Grant Can Teach Bumbles About Putting Down Violent Insurrections. I will have this link in the show notes, which you can find a link to if you don't want to write anything down. Just remember radiofreeva.com, radiofreeva.com, and go to the link there. It will take you over to Podbean, and Podbean is where I put all the notes and where you can subscribe if you haven't done that already. And use the Podbean player or Stitcher or any of these others. But you can find Radio Free Virginia on those. So I continue. The deadly siege of the Capitol in Washington, which sought to overturn a legitimate election by targeting lawmakers with assassination, was not the first attempted insurrection in American history. My goodness, there is so much propaganda in that one sentence. The deadly siege at the Capitol. You'd think that there was just a massacre, that there were bodies strewn everywhere. There weren't. Yes, it was deadly because a Capitol police officer shot an unarmed woman. And later, a Capitol police officer died from some mysterious injury that nobody actually has video of happening. Lawmakers were targeted with assassination. Yeah, were they? An insurrection. This was not an insurrection. During Reconstruction, a raft of attempted insurrections flared up across the former Confederacy. Violent storms of white supremacists rocked swaths of the South, all aimed at undoing the Union's victory during the Civil War, as well as the civil rights gained and made thereafter. I won't disagree with some of that. I'm not saying these things didn't happen, but the attempt here in all of this, as I read, just listen closely, is to paint you, the deplorable, evil constitutionalist, as a right-wing hater who must be executed. What occurred in the South in the late 1860s and 1870s was at the scope and scale of violence and resistance that was not even remotely similar to what we saw in Washington. Mark Pitcavage, a historian and senior fellow at the Anti-Defamation League, told me, "The scale of violence was so big that there are some people who say it was a low-intensity conflict. I don't know if I want to go all the way there, but parts of it weren't too far off from that." What he's saying was that none of that didn't even happen up in Washington. But yet they're using him to continue the argument that we're all just a bunch of racists. However, the echoes of Reconstruction-era violence led by both white marauders cloaked as Ku Klux Klan and other terrorist groups and white supremacist Democratic officials bent on reclaiming power from Republicans were impossible to escape in Washington in early January when rioters paraded Confederate flags through the halls of the Capitol and chanted threats to hang the vice president. Though largely overlooked by mainstream American history, these insurrections in Louisiana, in South Carolina, in Mississippi, in North Carolina, attempted to install terrorist-backed regimes in multiple post-Confederacy states. Their longevity was echoed as well in the warning last week from the Department of Homeland Security, which said for the first time publicly that the country faced a rising threat from violent domestic extremists who sympathized with the Capitol attack and the false narrative stoked by former President Donald Trump that the election was rigged. Well, it was rigged. We have to realize that this is a powerful strand in the American experience. It's always been here. The resistance to actual democracy. Republic. We live in a republic. I'm adding my commentary here. We live in a republic. I continue. Eric Fauner, a historian at Columbia University who specializes on Reconstruction, told me, "We pride ourselves on being a democracy. But there's actually a long tradition of people who don't think that, who are unwilling to accept the rights of African Americans to be citizens, the right of elections to overturn governments in power. In other words, we should realize the fragility of democratic culture. We don't live in a democracy. We do not live in a democracy. We live in a republic. And this is a tried and true, tested, working plan to overturn anything that is good in American culture. Let's call it democracy. Or say you're attacking our democracy. You see it in the book that I'm reading, I Led Three Lives. Constantly we hear this from the communists. And then they tie this in here, who are willing to accept the rights of African Americans. That's not even something we're talking about in this. And you know what? What about those rights of African Americans? How about the rights of those African Americans who voted overwhelmingly for Trump, except magically in these certain areas where Biden, Bumbles, needed to get the right amount of votes? What about those African Americans? You don't care about their voice. You don't care about those citizens. If you remember last week, I believe it was, where they were talking about the communists not really caring what really happened in the African community. Who cares? And they're not African anyway. Are these African Americans? Did they come from Africa? Wouldn't you be a Congolese American? A Libyan American? A Rhodesian American? A South African American? Instead of this nonsense of African American. You're a black man, I'm a white man. There's no racism there. While that fragility was on full display in the aftermath of the Civil War, as well as during the siege on the Capitol. What fragility? I disagree completely with the premise that this article is trying to make, of course. Those Reconstruction era insurrectionists contended with a force they constantly underestimated, Ulysses S. Grant, who served as president from 1868 to 1876. Rising to the presidency as a heroic general of the Civil War, Grant entered the White House amidst violent white extremists continuing to roil American politics and following the failed presidency of a one-term impeached president who had only added fuel to the post-war inferno. He's not talking about Donald Trump there, by the way. Grant's approach relied on a combination of brute military force and a drastic curtailment of civil liberties. Huh. We haven't seen that before, right? Yet it nevertheless has relevance for the current moment and contains lessons for lawmakers who fear that January 6 might have been only the first of widespread attacks on the government and elected officials at all levels across large swaths of the nation. Officials in our current era have many more legal tools at their disposal to combat such terrorism. But as Grant's experience shows, it's not just the tools that count, rather, it's the willingness to persist in the fight that will likely decide whether these counterterrorism efforts actually succeed. Once again, saying that you're a terrorist if you don't agree with everything that the propaganda machine has been saying. If you think this election was rigged, if you think this election was stolen, if you think that there's even irregularities, you're a domestic terrorist. And they need counterterrorist efforts to stop you. More importantly, creeping exhaustion began crawling across northern white communities, fatigued as they were by decades worth of combating white violence in the South, tired of seeing their boys off to fight fellow Americans, and uneasy about the potential of living in a republic, oops, they slipped that one in there, I think they meant to say a democracy, held together by bayonet. White northerners began wilting in the face of resurgent violence across the South. A sort of moral stagnation began to take root, rotting support for the administration to continue its anti-insurrection efforts. I skip ahead. There is, of course, much that is different between the insurrectionists of Reconstruction and those of the Trump era. The white supremacist insurrectionists of the 1870s, see, again, trying to tie you and make you a white supremacist insurrection, focused on just one region in the South, while the Trumpian insurrectionists have no geographic restrictions. This explains why, in the immediate aftermath of the January 6 riot, the FBI found it necessary to warn of potential attacks and insurrectionist activity on state capitals and federal buildings across the country. And I would point out there that that never happened. One, none of those events actually happened, and I would argue that no such thing actually existed. Find me the proof that they actually had intel that, to use their words, insurrectionists were going to have activity on state capitals and federal buildings across the country. Because I don't think you can find that. But if you squint, it's not too difficult to see how the insurrectionists of the 1870s and of the 2020s share a clear lineage. Racism. In many ways, the lost cause is now metamorphosed into the Trump lost cause. Racism. The first lesson, experts say, is relatively clear. As Trumpian insurrectionists continue popping up across the country, propelled by the big lie that Trump's re-election was stolen, and as Republican legislators saber-rattle about potential violence, if they don't get their way, who did this? The administration has to use the full range of tools at its disposal. There are so many more federal laws that can be used now, Pitt Cabbage says. Conspiracy laws that didn't exist in the 1870s, laws about federal property that didn't exist back then, laws about paramilitary training designed to foment civil disorder. Where do we have those laws? Right here in Virginia. They're talking about you, patriots. There are any number of laws in the books that now theoretically could be used. The regime, I changed that word, they said administration, the regime must make it clear, say experts, there is no quarter for insurrectionists in the American body politic, or for those who would abet their anti-democratic violence. The quicker you say, there's a line you can't cross, the better, Simpson said. That's armed resistance to the operations of government and its institutions. You can't cross that line, and if you do, we'll come down on you like you won't believe. And until that is understood and enforced to the fullest extent of the law, there can be no room for healing or for unity. That's what I think Bumbles has to understand, Simpson continued. You need to demand accountability and justice before you reach out and say, now let's heal. This is, if you remember, in Bumbles' very short speech, he said we need to have unity and come together. And most of the left is going, wait a second here. We can't come together with those guys. They're insurrectionists. They're white supremacists. They're racists. Racism. Bumbles, his regime, and his allies in Congress must be clear. Any threats of violence, of insurrection, of aiding and abetting democratic overthrow will be met with unswerving dedication to their prevention and prosecution. That goes for an outgoing president claiming the election was stolen from him. That goes for the far-right militias whining about not recognizing election outcomes. That goes for any insurrectionist who may look at the events in Washington as a success and who may thirst for more. Peace sometimes requires force to protect it, Foner told me, and what's needed is persistence, having the will to continue to maintain the peace. They want this government to come down on you like a big bag of bricks. Want it to dump right on your head and kill you. I've been saying this for, since this podcast started. They want to kill you. They want to kill you, and they're saying as much. Peace sometimes requires force to protect it. Well, I think the Republic sometimes requires force to protect it. How's that? Is that a threat of violence? Is that talk of insurrection? To actually want to have the country that we have? Skimming down to the very end, it here says, the stakes are actually bigger this time than during Reconstruction, because the legacy of this deplorable episode will be whether we question the very legitimacy of a process that depends upon the acceptance of its legitimacy in order for it to work. I think what the author is trying to say at the end here is that you can't question the legitimacy of this. And even if you do, it doesn't actually matter because it's legitimate because we say so. Which is funny because I'm pretty sure that for 4 years, they questioned the legitimacy of Trump's election and him as president with this fake made-up Russia hoax. So apparently you're only allowed to question the legitimacy of an election if the person elected is a Republican. If it's Democrat, you can never question that because that's going against Democratic policy and it's racist. Well, before I get to I Led Three Lives, I wanted to thank the show's sponsor, Acticare of the Blue Ridge, ACTIKARE.com/blue-ridge. Acticare is in-home senior care for your loved one when you can't be there. Whether you're in Smith Mountain Lake, in Lynchburg, out in the county, Roanoke, Bedford, and you're looking for great in-home senior care with a staff that cares about your loved ones and management, that's the people that run the company, John and his family, looking out for your loved ones. Check them out, ACTIKARE.com/blue-ridge, and get in touch with them. I was given my Facebook account back. I have no explanation for this whatsoever. I have a theory, which I'll get to in a second. But I'm not going to stay on Facebook. I've been telling all of you, you should be getting off of there, and I am going to get off. What I did was, how I found out about it was interesting. I was actually logging in to finish my taxes for 2019, which I never got around to doing. I was doing that stuff. And in that email account, which I never use anymore, is what my Facebook was tied to. And I started seeing all these notifications from Facebook. You know, you've got this thing was posted by this group, and this page was this, that, said this, and blah, blah, blah. I thought, well, that's odd. I mean, they deleted me. They got rid of my account. They said, bye-bye, you're banned. You're gone, deleted. Now it's been undeleted. And I don't understand what their thinking is, except I have a couple theories. Theory number one. They've been losing, hemorrhaging millions of Americans because of what Facebook and other social media outlets have done to Trump. And people are deleting their accounts. And so they needed a quick way to stop that hemorrhage, at least on paper. Well, the easiest way to do that is to unflip the switch that kicked us all off of there. And so that's what I think they did. The second reason I think they're doing this is they lost, as I've talked about before as well, they lost a huge intel source. Well, we don't know what Hank is thinking. If we don't know what Hank is thinking, how can we build a profile on him and get him in trouble for being a right-wing extremist, white supremacist, deplorable, you name the thing? And so I think that they've turned a lot of us back on because they want that intel. It was a huge, great intel source for them and for the deep state. So that's the main reason I won't be staying on there. What I'm going to do is I've already started the process of downloading all my photos and videos of my kids and everything that I couldn't get because of them shutting my account off. Once I've done that, I'm going to delete and unfriend. I'm going to unfriend everybody that isn't my mom and my wife and my in-laws. And that's it. And the reason is I want to keep a couple Facebook pages that I have until they get rid of those, until the Ministry of Truth says, you can't have this anymore. But I will be giving them no intel. I will almost never be logging on. I am not interested anymore in being a part of the Facebook's Ministry of Truth. I would like my Instagram account back, but they have not at this moment undeleted the deletion. So I don't know. We'll see. But if you're one of those people that got your account deleted, you might want to try and log back in because it might be working again.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Herbert A. Philbrick.
What is communism? I've been on the inside of communism. I still have contacts. From this knowledge, I tell you as simply and seriously as I know how. Communism is a lying, dirty, shrewd, godless, murderous, determined, as J. Edgar Hoover says, a criminal conspiracy. I'm choosing these words deliberately. Lying, dirty, shrewd, godless, determined, an international criminal conspiracy. This is the true nature of the enemy. This is communism.
Chapter 9, Communist Democracy in Action. At the time I took out my first party card and became a member in 1944, the Communist Party, under orders from the unfortunate Earl Browder, had cast itself adrift on a placid sea of cooperation with democratic capitalism in the United States. This improvement in the party's exterior appearance, which began so violently with the flip-flop after the 1941 attack by Hitler against Russia, had settled down into a quiet policy of collaboration, obscured from public attention by the war. It was a time of abnormal communist activity. The party cooperated willingly and enthusiastically with the constitutional authorities, eschewed all obstructionist tactics, and with singular purpose, aided in the prosecution and winning of the war. This was the mission of Earl Browder, wartime national chairman of the Communist Party in the United States. Browder went in up to the hilt. In Victory and After, a work which he frankly admitted was unorthodox, Browder laid down the National Party line and held out hope of collaboration with capitalism, not only in war but in peace as well, at least to achieve scientific socialism. The Communist Party swathed itself in patriotism and gave itself wholeheartedly to the winning of the war. At the same time, in secret classes in Cambridge, it was teaching me the necessity of violent revolution to hammer out a communist victory. But even this teaching did not go on for long. Browderism became so firmly entrenched that the leadership finally moved for a sort of public renunciation of international revolution and proposed the abolition of the Communist Party and the substitution of another name, the Communist Political Association. The move was in direct parallel to the previous shift from the Young Communist League to American Youth for Democracy. It also paralleled the gesture made by international communism in changing the name, if not the character, of the Comintern and calling it the Cominform instead. It was the most peaceful realignment of party policy I ever observed. The ground was well prepared, so that there was little opposition or confusion in the ranks. The only outward sign I saw was the sudden termination of Dave Bennett's classes on Marxist revolution. At national headquarters, William Z. Foster protested privately, but went along. Sam Darcy, a central committee man, protested publicly and was expelled. It was too peaceful. It had a strong suspicion that Comrade Browder's milk and honey might be a new palliative for the same old poison. 2 years earlier, I had bucked the party line on different grounds at the Hotel Terrain meeting. Now, I wondered what would happen if, as a regular party member, I demonstrated a reluctance to go along. My chance to needle the comrades and find out came during one of our cell meetings with Alice Gordon, soon after I joined the party. The subject for discussion was the National Committee's proposal for abolition of the party and creation of the milder and more cooperative Communist Political Association. The matter was so cut and dried that our new green membership cards in the CPA were already filled out, marked with our first names and a number, a registration fee for transfer to the new association, and our regular term dues were to be collected at the meeting. As the discussion proceeded on an even keel, I listened and chafed. Then I decided to rock the boat. Joining the conversation for the first time, I put in, "I don't know about this. I'm afraid of it. I don't think we're doing the right thing." All eyes fixed on me in a sustained silence. Some looked quizzical, as if they thought they hadn't quite heard me correctly. Others plainly understood and were stunned. The silence was so oppressive that I feared, perhaps, I had been too rash. All of my comrades had adjusted their thinking to the new situation, and my heresy was a deep shock. In spite of my vantage point within the party, it was impossible for me to understand such complete submission. It angered me to realize that the human mind could be so easily dominated, no matter what the cause. But I had stepped out of line, raising a question of party discipline, and they were flabbergasted. "What? Why, what do you mean, comrade?" Alice Gordon finally stammered. I pounced on the bait she offered. "There, you see? You call me comrade, but in the new association, it is supposed to be brother. That's exactly the sort of thing I mean. I can't get it through my head that what Comrade Browder says automatically changes everything. Not that I question the motives of the party. I mean, the association. I'm sure that it is proper and that we should do everything possible to retain the Big Three alliance and support an all-out war effort now. I agree that we ought to make some concessions to capitalism during this period, that we help the country to make war, boost production, eliminate strikes. But," another comrade broke in heartily, "if you agree with the policies of the party, what are you arguing about? What are you questioning? Or are you just trying to be an obstructionist?" "Now wait a minute," Alice said with a conciliatory tone, indicating that she was stepping over toward my side. "We are supposed to have a complete discussion on the subject, and every member has a chance to express himself. Communist democracy in action?" I felt it more likely that Alice was afraid of losing Comrade Herb, a good party hack with a lot of energy and some valuable connections. "If Brother Herb has some questions, we ought to clear them up," she said. I knew that I would be on unassailable ground if I stuck to a theme of revolution, to the doctrines that had been drilled into me with such diligence. "What I do question," I continued, "is not the party. It is the capitalists. I can't see us getting too friendly with them. We talk about cooperating with progressive capitalists such as Wendell Willkie. Whoever heard of a progressive capitalist? Personally, I don't trust the capitalists any more now than I ever did, and Comrade Browder can't change that. We talk about proposing Anglo-American trade agreements to guarantee Britain a share of world markets. What is all this about international free competition? I had read between the lines of Earl Browder's treatise, even if others hadn't. When this war is over, I added, you can be sure there will be no concessions by the capitalists towards free competition. The capitalists are in the fight only for themselves, and everyone knows it. They are in the fight for world markets and world control. We wrangled on and on. I quoted all I could remember off the cuff of the intransient portions of Marx, Lenin, and Engels. And I watched my brothers and sisters squirm in their chairs as if they tried to reason against my arguments. They could no more do it than, a few weeks before, they could convince me of the inevitable victory of world communism. Look, I persisted, borrowing a page from the uncompromising Bolshevism of Gus Johnson, the suppressed working people all over the world have been dreaming of the overthrow of their oppressors and the establishment of the dictatorship of the proletariat. For years, we have all been their champions in the struggle. Now, are we going to throw all that out the window, admit that we were wrong, or acknowledge that we are weak? The question spurred someone to answer with the suggestion that the revolution was not being canceled, merely postponed. That was what I was waiting for. Alice Gordon, hewing to the National Party line, said that because of the wartime unity of the Big Three and because of their decisions at Tehran, the entire world situation has changed. Now, she declared, it might be possible to achieve peacetime prosperity and bring about the changes we sought towards socialism by working through a democratic government and economic free enterprise. There was no sense in prolonging the discussion. They had acknowledged that no basic change was intended, but only that new methods might be tried. It was to be a period of opportunism. I gave ground by degrees until finally I was able to relent altogether. All right, I said, I'll go along. But Tehran? The international capitalists and monopolists. Agreements such as those at Tehran are but pieces of paper. The imperialists will tear them up at the first opportunity and double-cross us as soon as they have a chance. But I could be wrong. I'll stick with you until I'm proved right. The meeting broke up in confusion. Our cards were handed around, and we were instructed to make a mental note of the number and tear them up. Most members of the CPA would keep their cards, but those of us who were undercover would not run any risk of detection. We examined the new cards. A wastebasket was furnished for us to drop them in. In the confusion of disbanding, with many of the cell members keeping me busy by informal continuation of the dispute I had started, I took a risk. I surreptitiously avoided tearing up my card and slipped it in my pocket for transmission to the FBI. I took the chance that the wastebasket scraps might be examined. Fortunately, they were not. I was a little uneasy about how the tangent I had taken to turn the party line might be regarded in high places. At least I knew that I would need some little time to purge myself of it. Even so, there were strong implications in Browder's thesis, which told me that his deviation was not so much a matter of principle as one of opportunism. At least I was down in the book indelibly as a Bolshevik, and it seemed unlikely that I could be chastised too severely for adherence to the traditional historic mission of the Communist Party, only a few weeks previously the subject of intensive study in my secret classes. Nevertheless, there was a distinct chill in headquarters circles, and I worked hard to overcome it. I was assigned almost immediately to the propaganda division of the district office, where the sign on the door had been changed to Communist Political Association. My acquaintance with advertising, publicity, and public relations work was put to use, and I began grinding out bulletins and news releases by the score on the old, battered office mimeograph machine. Here was a chance to ingratiate myself again by demonstrating that my deviation did not affect my devotion. The mimeograph was in bad shape, and I suggested that it should be thoroughly cleaned and overhauled, but the manufacturer's representative in Boston wouldn't handle the job, so I ordered a quantity of benzene, acquired a bundle of rags, and went to work on it. I tore down the machine, cleaned, oiled it, ordered new replacement parts, and put it together again. It worked like new, and everyone was pleased. Next, I devoted time and effort to cutting of stencils, introduced some attractive lettering and artwork in simple layouts and designs, and stepped up the quality of the bulletins. There was method in my desire to please. Gradually, it paid off, so that when any important material was to be mimeographed for distribution, general or secret, I was called in for consultation and to help with the job. Therefore, few decisions were reached in party affairs, major or minor, that I didn't know about, and the FBI shared my knowledge. The district office in the little building was the focal point of communist operations throughout all of New England, and so I was in an extremely advantageous position as an intelligence agent for the Bureau. Still, I had not yet gone as far in the party confidence as I had hoped. Therefore, I had to move with redoubled caution to avoid any misstep that would tip my hand prematurely. Headquarters office unwittingly helped me by screening my movements from the public and the police. I was given careful instructions concerning my visits to the little building offices. I was told to come at different times of the day, to ride on different elevators so I wouldn't become too well known to the operators, and to get off a floor above or below the office. They were sound precautions. It would have been just as unhealthy for me to be recognized by business associates as a visitor to communist headquarters as it would be to be unmasked within the party as an FBI confidant. The office suite consisted of four rooms at the end of the corridor on the Tremont Street wing of the building, next door to the Majestic Theater and directly across the street from the Hotel Touraine. There was a small anteroom with a reception desk, typewriter, and the rejuvenated mimeograph and a bank of card files. Off the anteroom, on one side, were a corner office and a conference room. The corner office on the other side contained two desks and a table, the latter piled high with party literature. Over the table was a bulletin board for important notices. This room led into the inner sanctum of Fanny Hartman, the district organizer and the real district leader. Fanny was a graduate of Simmons College and a vest pocket edition of party stalwart Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. But what she lacked in size and power, she more than made up for in skill and precision. As the strategic brain of the New England Communist Party, she demanded and received unwavering loyalty from everyone under her jurisdiction. She exacted it because of a basic foundation of toughness over which she spread a thin veneer of charm, so that while she had a pleasant way of putting things, she left no room for doubt. As one comrade expressed it to me, "When Fanny tells you something, you damned well better pay attention and follow orders and produce results." She was a woman of few words, who could listen to hopeless wrangling among the other district leaders and then neatly cut through to a solution, throwing off the trivial and irrelevant. She had the ability to accomplish as much work as three ordinary persons in a day and still retain inexhaustible strength and stamina. She was a mannish woman, at home in a man's world, and yet she commanded a genuine affection and deep friendship from other women. Fanny might have asked and would have received a salary well in advance of most men in business. Yet there she was, working for a party pittance in the drab district headquarters. She was in time double-crossed and crushed by the very machine to which she had enslaved herself. In 1945, she was elbowed aside by the national hierarchy in favor of Emanuel Blum, who was a more powerful political strategist, but a heavy-handed dolt by comparison with her. Under his direction, the District 1 organization began falling apart. Where Fanny Hartman used a scalpel with consummate skill, Blum wielded a club. It was unfortunate for Fanny and the communist cause that the party traditionally honored the latter method for reaching its objectives. Finesse had little place in the class struggle of Lenin, which is perhaps one reason why Karl Marx himself has been so largely abandoned in favor of the more direct revolutionary science of Lenin and Stalin. Otis Hood was the frontman for the party in New England, nominally the Massachusetts chairman, a public communist who perpetually ran on the party ticket for offices ranging from governor of Massachusetts to Boston school committeeman. Another in the public eye was Anne Burlack, known throughout New England as the Red Flame, a title she acquired not from the color of her hair, which was blonde, but because of her leadership in violent strike activities in Lawrence, Lowell, Providence, and other cities in the area. She was not averse to physical combat with the police and had been known to tangle with as many as three at a time. William Harrison was another occupant of the district office, the perennial vice president of the district. Bill held a title which had neither meaning nor power. He was the editor of the Boston Chronicle, a Negro newspaper, a foil for communist agitation and propaganda. Bill was a cipher so far as influence in the party was concerned, but he always did exactly as he was told. It was from Fanny Hartman that I got my first inkling of the innermost secret organization of a political conspiracy that is based on concentric circles of secrecy. The cell to which I belonged was too sour over my deviation, even though it was an anti-capitalist deviation. to elect me as a delegate to the District 1 convention in the late spring of 1944. At the last moment, however, I received a call from Fanny Hartman. "I think it would be good if you would come to the convention," she said. "I don't know," I wavered. "Don't you think it might be dangerous? Too public?" "Oh no," was her reply. "It would be a closed meeting, with no one in attendance but the most trusted members, nobody from the press." I agreed to go. There were three types of cards for admission to the convention. One color for delegates, one for alternates, and a third for important and approved visitors, of whom there were only a few, such as observers from other districts and national figures in the party. When I reached the credentials table, barring the entrance door to the conference room at Horticultural Hall, I found myself without the proper password in the form of one of these cards. I explained my plight to the girl in charge and said that Fanny Hartman had asked me to be present. The girl called Fanny out of the conference hall to check my story. Fanny greeted me warmly and then went into a huddle with the credentials official. Finally, they produced a visitor's card on which Fanny wrote my first name. She paused reflectively a moment, then scribbled another entry on the card and handed it to me. "Here," she said, "this will take you in and out for the various sessions." I thanked her and the girl at the door and passed inside, glancing at the card before I tucked it into my pocket. Across the face of the card was written Herb, and then the cryptic designation, Pro 4. Pro 4? In all of my associations with communists and their front organizations, I had never before heard of such a tag. At headquarters and elsewhere, I'd run across countless names of party cells and groups, names like the Dorchester Debs or John Reed Club, but this was new to me. And for a long time, a matter of years, I wondered about and searched for the answer to Pro 4. I sent the Pro 4 information along to Hal Leary as another minute fact that might fit somewhere into the puzzle. By this point in my career, I was thoroughly accustomed to my role as confidential agent to the FBI and had a fair idea of what they wanted. I made no effort to draw any inference from what I saw or heard in my peregrinations around the party. In my reports to the Bureau, I expressed no opinions. I sent in assorted facts, many of them probably useless, some, as it turned out, vital. The physical job of relaying such a mass of information was so great that I could not take time to appraise it. I picked up everything I could without actually rifling the headquarters. Files, copies of directives turned out by mimeograph, sheets of discarded carbon paper on which a letter was legible, hasty notes on scratches of conversation, telephone numbers, and addresses. If a party functionary scrawled a memorandum on a tablet, I made an excuse to get the underlying sheet of paper off the pad. "Let me make a note," I would say, reaching for the tablet, scribbling a brief notation in one corner and leaving the main part of the paper undisturbed. Although the pressure of the pencil or pen that had made the previous memo was invisible to the naked eye, the disturbance of the fibers in the paper was indelible, and the message written by the functionary could easily be deciphered by the Bureau's scientific laboratories. My spying was entirely objective and impersonal. While maintaining as best I could the rigid discipline of a party member, I served as a pipeline to the Bureau, a funnel through which flowed a vast amount of material for Bureau experts to screen, appraise, and use as they saw fit. More often than not, the FBI knew of a forthcoming meeting, including the date, place, those in attendance, speakers, even what the speaker would say, long before the information was in the hands of the rank-and-file party members. These things were discussed in detail over Fanny Hartman's desk, and I frequently sat in on the outlining of speeches, policies, and plans for meetings of party units. I learned to appreciate the basic tenet of intelligence work, that it is inadvisable for the operative to know too much about the activities on which he is spying. There is always a long chance that a slip of the tongue may reveal his awareness of something he's not supposed to know. If he doesn't become too familiar with all the details, the risk of such a slip is minimized. The rule of Secret Service is especially applicable even when inside a group like the Communist Party, where every member, no matter how trusted he may be, is constantly under suspicion and subject to examination and tests. For even while my spying was most active, I felt that I was most persistently spied upon. One night after a meeting at the Bennett apartment in Cambridge, I walked toward a bus stop on Massachusetts Avenue for a bus to North Station. I suddenly became aware that I was being followed. I thought it possible that my imagination might be deceiving me, so I determined to give it a test. It was a warm night and a dark one, an ideal evening for a pleasant stroll. I walked in leisurely fashion, enjoying the evening air, halfway across Cambridge. Following a circuitous route down dark, gaslit streets, stopping to look into store windows, wandering almost aimlessly. I headed in the general direction of the Central Square subway station, where I could catch a train to North Station. All that distance, despite the twists and turns I made across the city, the shadow stayed a discreet distance behind me until I entered the subway. Who was it? One of the Communist Review Board agents, the equivalent of the Soviet KGB in America, a member of the undercover Red Squad of the police department. I was very much aware that the Boston police had a very excellent plainclothes intelligence unit. Was my tail an operative from Army or Navy intelligence? Both of these wartime units had very good reason to view the shenanigans at the Bennett apartment with well-founded alarm. Of course, I shall never know. There were wheels within wheels, and no one never knew, at any given time, which way the wheels were spinning, for you or against you. The only thing to do was not worry about it, keep going as nearly straight ahead as possible, and stay out of trouble. And that wasn't the easiest thing to do. During midsummer, I was boxed into serving as a host for an AYD outing at Lake Quanapowhat, a public beach in Wakefield near my house. Many of those whom came were persons I knew to be members of the party. I hoped that the Wakefield residents at the beach that day wouldn't recognize them too. Worse, while at the beach, a group of the AYDers used the opportunity to cordially ransack my house. Since no money or anything of value was taken, and since little or no pain was taken to cover their tracks, it was obvious that they were searching for some sign of deviation by Comrade Herb, and they didn't care if I knew about it. While the young communist AYD members were prying into my affairs, I was able to turn a small-scale coup on them. As a motion picture hobbyist, I made a complete film record of the outing, which went into FBI files for identification purposes, identification, that is, of those who attended. Few, however, persistently turned their backs to the lens. The AYD affair had its sardonic aftermath. Barbara Copland at M&P Theaters, fully aware of my activities in the organization, cautioned me that I'd better get out of AYD because she said it was about to be investigated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I asked her to identify the investigators, but she declined. I was watched even at my work in the M&P Theaters office. The party worked comrades into employment with M&P, where they could keep an eye on me. Not too difficult a task, since we obtained part-time and temporary help through a war-imposed manpower shortage secretarial pool. One of them, a girl who made no effort to conceal her extreme left sympathies, aroused the deep resentment of the entire office staff by frequently indulging in communist-line discussions. What was worse, my secretary was gravely concerned that in these discussions I did not, as indeed I could not, come out in the comrades' presence with a firm stand against communism. Her loyalty would not permit her to believe that I was one of them. But she became so concerned about her apparent drift of my attitudes that she even went to Harry Browning to ask him to give me a raise. She argued that economic necessity was threatening to convert me to communism. I was beginning to make a good show of it in spite of myself. There was another spy in my office. She was an elderly woman, a reticent person who did not indulge in any overt communist activity. I paid little attention to her until one day I was working on some theatrical post-American Legion mailing pieces for Harry Browning. Just as the woman passed my desk, while I was reading over some work, I abstractly muttered, "Dear comrade," a salutation frequently used among legionnaires. The words stopped her as though she had been struck. She stared at me, open-mouthed and flushed, then turned and fled in confusion. She quit her job shortly thereafter. I doubt that she could have learned anything damaging to report to the review board. Still, I was glad to see her go. On the other side of the fence, I had to be equally careful. I couldn't afford to be known in my private or business life as a communist. The FBI, I had been warned, would not stand behind me to acknowledge that I was a confidential informer, and my career in advertising would have been ruined. By the middle of 1944, I expected that I would soon be called up in the draft. I had taken my physical examination and been classified as available for limited service because of an eye injury suffered when I was a youth. Anticipating the call, I moved from Wakefield to smaller and more compact quarters in nearby Melrose, only to find that I had moved directly across the street from Gus Johnson's wife. The same Mrs. Johnson, who Jack Green had warned me about, was a stool pigeon, who started the anti-communist ruckus in Wakefield several years before. I had been assigned the task, once more, of moving into the party set up in Wakefield to convert it from the Communist Party to a branch of the Communist Political Association. In the course of this work, several comrades or brothers and sisters came to my Melrose house from time to time, and one of my most frequent callers was Gus Johnson. Gus was separated from his wife, but was also living in Melrose. He visited his wife occasionally. I didn't like the idea of his coming to see me under Mrs. Johnson's watchful eye, and I said so. And Gus was hard to persuade. He didn't care for undercover communist activity anyway, and held to the brash theory that every good communist should be willing to stand up in the public square and be counted. But I convinced him that I was under orders to remain covered. Gus went ahead on his own and provided a solution. Gus liked the ponies as well as his whiskey, and he confided to his wife that I was a bookie. Word flashed rapidly around the neighborhood. I was considerably puzzled when some of the neighbors eyed me coldly until I learned what had happened. I was warned several times by the Bureau that traps would be set for me by the party, and to be wary of them. On one occasion, I was scheduled to mimeograph and mail out a large quantity of party material from the district headquarters office. Several days before I undertook the job, Chairman Otis Hood made a special point of telling me that, on that particular night, all of the headquarters personnel would be busy elsewhere, and the office would be deserted. On the appointed afternoon, I showed up just before closing time. Hood suggested that he give me his keys so that I could return after a quick supper and continue my work. He showed me exactly where to put the key when I left for the night, in the top drawer of the receptionist's desk by the front window, and admonished me to be sure to lock the office door and close it tight. I assured him that I would and went out to supper. When I returned, there was no one in the office. This was my first perfect opportunity. Now I could get my hands on any quantity of material in the office files, in Hood's desk, in Fanny Hartman's sanctorum. It was too perfect. Instead, I stayed right on the job in the outer office. I did not go into any of the other rooms. I worked at the mimeograph machine, at the card files, and at the typewriter, by the reception desk directly in front of the window, where I could be seen plainly from the building across the street. When I left, I stepped to the drawer of the desk by the big window and carefully placed the key where Hood had ordered me. Then I closed the drawer, turned out the light, checked the snap lock on the door, and closed it tight. There had not been a single indiscreet move on my part, for across the street in the hotel terrain, I knew there were party watchers scrutinizing me carefully with binoculars through the big front windows of the district office. They could see where I went, and they could plainly observe me replacing the office key in the designated place. How I knew all this, at such an early stage in the game, must still remain a secret. Had I pocketed the key and taken it out with me even for a few minutes, it would have been fatal. Had I poked into any files or desk drawers where I had no right to be, I would have been promptly expelled from the party and my usefulness would have ended. But turnabout is fair play. During that long evening in the district office, where the party counter-spies could watch my actions but not my plans, I was able to devise a scheme, the details of which must still remain a secret. It gave to the FBI information they wanted on directives and secret documents covering the party plans and policies in New England. The district leaders do not know to this day how it was done. So there's a couple funny things that I enjoy about Herb's personality. How he, when he gets opportunities, he likes to just stir the pot, kind of stick it to these communist rats, mess with their heads. And so he does some of that in this chapter. But a couple other things stood out to me where he says, all eyes fixed on me in a sustained silence. Some looked quizzically as if they thought they hadn't quite heard me correctly. Others plainly understood and were stunned. The silence was so oppressive that I feared perhaps I had been too rash. All of my comrades had adjusted their thinking to the new situation, and my heresy was a deep shock. In spite of my vantage point within the party, it was impossible for me to understand such complete submission. It angered me to realize that the human mind could be so easily dominated, no matter what the cause. But I had stepped out of line, raising a question of party discipline, and they were flabbergasted. So, he's even though he knows how the system works and how it played and the game is played, he still is having trouble wrapping his mind around how these people can so self-deceive and delude themselves so quickly. And yet they can. And we see this, well, we see this now. I mean, look around, with whether it's COVID or Bumbles being sworn in, or any of the number of things that we see that are just blatantly the opposite of the way they should be. And so many people have just accepted them, including conservatives, patriots, whatever, what have you. Another thing that jumped out, I learned to appreciate the basic tenet of intelligence work, that it is inadvisable for the operative to know too much about the activities on which he is spying. There's always a long chance that a slip of the tongue may reveal his awareness of something he is not supposed to know. If he doesn't become too familiar with all the details, the risk of such a slip is minimized. This rule of Secret Service is especially applicable when working inside a group like the Communist Party, where every member, no matter how trusted he may be, is constantly under suspicion and subject to examination and tests. So you can think about it, if you knew the full plan, whatever it was, and you're on the inside trying to gather intelligence, and you think, well, I need to get some more information, so you ask a question, and maybe it slips that you have a little bit more information than you should have. So that's what he's saying here. It's really interesting. It's true of all intelligence, not just infiltrating the Communist Party. It's also true of those who would infiltrate our movements, whether that be militia, the Republican Party, conservatism, whatever. You got to understand that the enemy wants in and wants information about us, probably more than we want information about them. We don't do a very good job of doing that. We're all working, we're doing our thing, and we just want to be left alone. And so you have to imagine that these people, some of them are getting paid to do this stuff, whether it's by the FBI, whether it's Antifa, Black Lives Matter, George Soros's pet group of the month, whatever. You have to imagine that they have people trained to be spies and to get inside your organization. And as you'll see later in the book, you know, those movements and those spies are used to sow destruction and damage and all kinds of interesting things. And so let's see, we're about halfway through the book, which is pretty awesome, almost halfway, and hope you're enjoying that. What an amazing guy. I mean, just the stuff to go day in and day out for years. I couldn't do it. I don't have the patience for it. But he did it. Well, thank you for listening. And remember, you were not made to fit in. You were born to stand out. I'm Hank Reardon. This is Radio Free Virginia. God bless you.
Victory or death! Victory or death!
Victory or death!